Track 13. Our historian explores the lives of valiant siblings Derek Seagrim, VC, and Hugh Seagrim, GC, DSO, MBE.
No man have greater love than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. The Gospel according to St. John, chapter 15, verse 13. Only twice before in the 5 or 6 years I've been writing this column have I written about a pair of brothers. The first pair, Lord Charles and Frederick Townsend, set out together from Yarmouth by carriage to travel to London. On arrival, Lord Charles was found dead from a gunshot wound on the carriage seat. The driver reported having seen Lord Frederick throw a pistol out of the coach en route. The second were George and Thomas Manby, respectively the inventor of a range of safety equipment and a naval hero. Neither lived a life entirely free of scandal. This time there is no question that the story of the brothers Seagrim is one that should be better known, and there is not a hint of any scandal. They were as honourable as they were brave. They were two of the 5 sons of the Reverend Charles Seagrim, rector of Wissenset, all of whom became soldiers. Educated at Norwich School, then King Edward VI School, Derek went almost directly to Sandhurst. Almost, because, having failed to gain a place, he was later admitted after another candidate dropped out. The army was really only a third choice for Hugh. He had hoped to train as a doctor, but lack of funds following the death of his father put a stop to this. His second choice was the Royal Navy, but the fact that he was colourblind precluded that, so he followed Derek to Sandhurst. After Sandhurst, their early army careers diverged, but both started their military lives overseas. Travel was in the family nature. Their father had for many years been a missionary in South Africa. In those days of empire, and with the Palestinian mandate in place, Derek served successfully in Jamaica, Palestine, and Shanghai, and was for a while seconded to the King's African Rifles in Kenya. Hugh joined the Indian Army and also served in Burma. Their paths probably barely crossed, but they both progressed in their careers steadily. The onset of war found Derek in Egypt serving as a staff officer responsible for air liaison in Africa and Greece. Hugh was still serving in Burma and had become very attached both to the country and the people. The fondness was reciprocated. Each was serving in a different theatre of war and in different capacities. Very different, too, were the sets of circumstances in which each was to distinguish himself by his outstanding courage. Derek's VC was won, as were others, by an act of almost instinctive bravery of the most extreme kind, in an action which allowed little time for thought. Hugh was recognised not for a single moment's action, but for an extended period of time living in the greatest danger and in then surrendering his own life in a deliberate attempt to save others, acting in the sort of honourable manner which one normally associates with the usually uncritical empire literature of the likes of a Kipling, a Haggard, or a Henty. Looking first at Derek, we find him picking up the pieces of the 7th Green Howards following the battering they had taken at Tobruk in 1942. It was his first senior command. He was to earn his VC in the El Alamein campaign. Charged with taking a major defensive position behind a deep anti-tank ditch, he was under intense fire and taking heavy casualties. Recognising that if his attack failed, the larger objective could not be achieved, Derek personally helped to put out a scaling ladder across the ditch and was the first to cross it armed with a pistol and some grenades. He single-handedly attacked 2 machine gun posts, putting both out of commission and killing or capturing an estimated 20 opponents, enabling the success of their assault. Defending a counterattack the following day, he deliberately shifted from position to position, exposing himself to enemy fire whilst encouraging his men. The citation in the Gazette ends, "His valour, disregard for personal safety, and outstanding example, he so inspired his men that the battalion successfully took and held, thereby allowing the attack to proceed." a classic example of instinctive courage and leadership not untypical of those brave men who were awarded the Victoria Cross. Although Derek survived the action, he died as a result of a wound received about 6 months later at the Battle of Wadi Akarit. The story of Hugh's War is very different, and it represents one of the most moving I have ever researched. After Sandhurst, he joined the Indian Army, being commissioned in the 19th Hyderabad Regiment before being attached to the Burma Rifles. He learnt Burmese very quickly, but was in India when the war broke out. Flown back immediately to Rangoon and posted near the Thai border, he was responsible for establishing a corps of local resistance fighters when the Japanese invaded. He relocated into the heart of Karen territory. The Karens occupied a fiercely independently minded state in Burma. There, he raised a substantial number of freedom fighters, though initially with insufficient weapons to arm them. The Karens fought fiercely against the invading Japanese, and even when overwhelmed by the latter's superior numbers and equipment, they inflicted considerable casualties. Even more significantly, they managed to delay the Japanese advance by the destruction of bridges and the damage they did to industrial equipment. The British were evacuating fast, but the Karens stuck by them. As the British withdrew, Seagram stayed behind Japanese lines, charged with gaining intelligence, finding the means of getting what was discovered back to India, and in the meantime causing as much mayhem as possible for the Japanese occupiers. The Special Operations Executive, the SOE, became involved, dropping both men and radio equipment to Seagram in the jungle. Seagram's guerrillas were making a thorough nuisance of themselves, and the Japanese realized they had to do something about it. Seagram was then living dressed as a Karen himself, though his height, 6'4", his nickname was Grandfather Longlegs, must have made him fairly conspicuous, and he successfully kept out of sight in the jungle while organizing sabotage and providing intelligence for some time. But the Japanese had brought in a special unit to search for him and his group, and by the use of torture and threats they managed to get a clue from the local community as to his approximate whereabouts. Once this was established, life became much more difficult for Seagram. Time was running out for him. The Japanese were determined to rid themselves of him and his group. A special unit of the Japanese military police was moved to the locality for this purpose, and, by the use again of torture, discovered the precise locations of two British officers who had been parachuted in to support Seagram, but whose camps were not in the same location as his. Both were killed, but Seagram had not yet been located. To find him, the Japanese began to brutally torture local villagers, who were also made to join Japanese search parties looking for Seagram. One of his men, unable to any longer bear the treatment being meted out locally, is said to have talked through the situation with a trusted fellow Karen. The trust was not deserved, and the information was passed on, which meant that the search could now be more targeted. The Japanese then, on the threat of destroying his village and dealing with the entire population, including children, if he failed, sent a local headman into the jungle to locate Seagram, which he did. It is said that when the situation was explained to Seagram, it was suggested that, to avoid torture, the best course would be for him to commit suicide and let the Japanese discover his body. He is said to have rejected this immediately and declared instead that he would give himself up without delay, which he did, having first given his watch to the headman, asking that it be sent to his mother in England. He then surrendered to the Japanese officer in command, begging that the Karens should be spared, and seeking to take the blame himself for all the damage done by this group. Initially, the officer appeared to be sympathetic to his plea. The two men even enjoyed a smoke together, Seagram commenting that it was the first cigarette he'd enjoyed since living in the jungle. With others, he was then marched to a military prison near Rangoon and faced trial. Found guilty, he and several of his Karen colleagues were executed by firing squad. But not until he had made one further plea for clemency for his Karen colleagues. Typical of the man. It is perhaps an irony that Seagram's last long pre-war leave had been an extended three-month tour of Japan, when he formed an affection for both the country and its people. One thing which repeatedly struck me as I researched Hugh Seagrim's War was the remarkable number of parallels with Edith Cavell. Both children of Norfolk clergy, both imbued with an exceptionally deep-rooted Christian belief, each possessing extreme courage, an extraordinary sense of duty, and an absolute determination to do the right thing regardless of personal cost. They were both remarkable people who sacrificed their lives for the good of others. We in Norfolk should be very proud of both and of Hugh's brother, Derek.